Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Popular Music podcast. In today's podcast, I speak with Sherry Tucker about her new book, Dance Floor Democracy, The Social Geography of Memory at the Hollywood Canteen. In the book, Sherry Tucker explores how jitterbugging swing culture has come to represent World War II in U.S. national memory. Hey, Sherry.
Hey, Rit.
Well, thanks for doing this interview. Could you please tell me a little bit about yourself and why you decided to write this book?
Sure, Rich. And first of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to read my book and for the opportunity to talk about it. I am a professor of American Studies at University of Kansas in Lawrence, and my work has been primarily about jazz and gender and race. And more recently, my work has been, I say recently, like the last 10 years, I've also been really interested in improvisation studies, which has a slightly different but very complementary orientation to jazz studies as an interdisciplinary field. I'm also an oral historian, so much of my work involves a methodology of open interviews with people where I sit down and, listen not only to the content of what people have to say, but also about the ways that people tell the story and the ways that they tell it to me in a moment in time.
Why did you decide to write this book? Why the Hollywood Canteen?
Well, this book, like many projects, came out of a previous project. So I was working on my first book, which was called Swing Shift, All-Girl Bands of the 1940s. And in that book, I interviewed women musicians from all women jazz and swing bands who had been active throughout the war years playing big band music. And that project brought the Hollywood Canteen to me. I knew what the Hollywood Canteen was, and in case anybody listening doesn't know what it is, let me just say the Hollywood Canteen was a very famous club, like a USO club, where civilians would entertain soldiers. And during World War II, a lot of those clubs involved jitterbugging. So there would be swing music and people jitterbugging and people volunteering to make sandwiches and all of this stuff with the troops. So the Hollywood Canteen was the super famous version of such a club. And it was located in Hollywood on the corner of Cahuenga and Sunset in this big wooden barn-like structure. The soldiers standing in lines outside, waiting to get in, and the volunteers would enter in through the back. And it shows up in documentaries about home front, the home front war years. It shows up sometimes in reenactments of World War II swing culture. So, but the way the Hollywood Canteen came back to me in a different way was that the women musicians that I talked to, several of them talked about it as a kind of a different and interesting place, sometimes in terms of race. Now, Hollywood was very segregated during World War II. This is something that that even the people, the white people in Hollywood, didn't necessarily know. Having to do with this spatial arrangement of Los Angeles, which is enormous. So if a neighborhood is a white kind of a white neighborhood where people of color have difficulty gaining entrance, or it's unpredictable in gaining entrance to restaurants and nightclubs and stuff. But the white people there might not even realize they live in a segregated area if it's cushioned by other such neighborhoods where there's no official rules like Jim Crow rules, but that there are, establishments that won't allow people in, et cetera. So the Hollywood Canteen is smack dab in the middle of Hollywood, but it was apparently, according to some of the people who talked to me and also the newspaper reports of the day, it was apparently integrated. And so here's a contradiction. Is it's supposed to be integrated. And then when I started looking at the biographies and autobiographies of movie stars and reading about what they did at the Hollywood Canteen, it's celebrated as integrated there too. But then when you look at pictures of the Hollywood Canteen, and there are millions of them, they're almost always predominantly or actually entirely apparently white. So one starts to wonder, integrated for whom? You know, is this an integrated dance floor in Hollywood that everyone experiences as integrated? Is it one of those photo ops that corporations often do? I mean, apparently it's not a photo op, but is it some kind of a narrative opportunity to say it's integrated, but it's a colorblind version where it's not really integrated? So I started thinking, you know, my last project was interviewing people in swing culture, World War II settings that had been completely forgotten. What if I had went to one that was, kind of relentlessly remembered in a particular way and invited a diverse group of former canteen goers to talk about what they remembered about their bodies on that dance floor?
Well, because this is a podcast dedicated to popular music, one thing I wanted to get your thoughts on is what is the relationship between dance and popular music? What insights can we gain about music when we look at it through the lens of the dance floor?
This was a revelation to me, and I'm so happy that you bring this up. I have to say that this project also brought me to dance, and I wish I'd been brought to dance much, much earlier. I don't know what generation you're in. I think I'm completely older than you are, I think. I came up in the kind of freeform acid dancing generation where we didn't do partner dancing. And so that was my dance orientation, and which I thoroughly enjoyed, and there's nothing wrong with it. But this was a different kind of dance. And here I am, a swing scholar who had not really had experience in partner dancing. And I had to learn about it. I had to talk to dancers. I had to take dance lessons. I read the rich body of dance literature that is absolutely amazing in terms of talking about musical perception, among other things. So what dance brings is embodiment. It brings perception. It brings multiple perspectives. It brings an attention and awareness to the ways that music is perceived, not only through cochlear hearing, but through vibration, the other ways that vibrations reach bodies. And so, even sitting in a chair, it makes me think about music differently to have done that work in dance. It makes me aware of when I'm listening to music and, whether I'm in a chair or I'm dancing or I'm moving around, that I'm experiencing that music through various resonant areas of my body, sometimes my chest. Sometimes when I'm listening to music, I pay more attention to I might be hearing it, feeling it, coming up through the floor in my feet or in my chair. So I think that I guess what I'm doing right here is I'm giving a plea to anybody out there who writes about popular music who has not looked at dance. And I know many people have. But if anyone has not looked at dance, go look at the dance literature and think about the way that dance scholars and dancers experience and talk about music, because it certainly changed the way I thought about music. I'm sad it had to hit me over the head by being a swing scholar who'd never looked at swing dance, but it is, I highly, highly recommend it.
The book uses the phrase dance floor democracy in the title. What do you mean by this?
Okay. Dance floor democracy. First of all, let me talk about what I think there's kind of two levels to this title that I want to touch on. One is that dance floor democracy gets at the way that the Hollywood Canteen dance floor was written about in the press of the day, and the way that it has been nostalgified in the way that the Hollywood Canteen is remembered as a site of particular democratic dancing where as many people are benefiting from that experience as possible. Dancing that represents the nation, that represents equality and lack of hierarchy and stuff like that. So that's one. So there's the nostalgified version of that. And then there's kind of the version that I'm trying to look at, which involves looking at the nostalgic contradictions and trying to find an alternative way of thinking about it. So first of all, the nostalgic version of dance floor democracy relies on some interesting foundations. First of all, it relies on this notion that movie stars being so generous that they will give up their time to make sandwiches and jitterbug with soldiers as a symbol of democracy has a slight irony to it, or a big irony to it, in that it is class-based, right? It's an idea that the rich and famous are so generous, they're so patriotic, that they will give up their valuable time to dance with soldiers who are, you know, possibly giving up their lives, giving up careers, giving up, leaving families, leaving loved ones, and shipping off to war. And so there's already a hierarchy at the root of a kind of vision of democracy. Now, I'm not saying this to debunk that the volunteer work that the people in the motion picture industry or anybody did. I really am not trying to do that. I'm just saying that there's an interesting contradiction built into, you know, why is the Hollywood Canteen more patriotic than, say, the downtown YWCA that was doing the same thing, or the YWCA in YMCA on Central Avenue that was doing the same thing. So that's one contradiction. Another is that the nostalgia at the same time remembers the Hollywood Canteen as colorblind and integrated and also as white. So that's a kind of contradiction. So in that it's so slippery. It is a way of, and this is like, you know, don't you see this sometimes everywhere in American culture? It's like there's this simultaneous celebration of being past all of that, race-based, class, you know, class and race-based hierarchy is like, oh, we're kind of pushed past that. And then at the same time, this kind of blatant representation of a space that ignores that history. And so that's the nostalgic version. Here's an example, too. Like a lot of times I will see the Hollywood canteen represented even today, like in a World War II museum or in a documentary or something. And the text will say it was entirely integrated. Everyone was welcome. And then the picture will have white people on the dance floor and then maybe Lena Horne or another famous African-American entertainer on stage entertaining. So that's really an interesting separation of people dancing together, people being together, but in very different ways. So the site, what nostalgia, the job of nostalgia, if we put it that way, is to contain contradictions, literally to contain contradictions. So one of the things that's interesting to do is to take out the contradictions in nostalgia and just sort of line them up and look at them. And so, I wanted to look at the contradictions to see if we could come up with another way of thinking about how a dance floor could be a practice of democracy. And here I'm quoting Danielle Goldman's work on improvised dance as a practice of freedom. So how could a dance floor be a place where people are together, moving together, and, you know, best case scenario, something happens there with people moving together with the intention of kind of creating a place where everybody benefits from the ways that we're moving together, that we're doing something together that we couldn't do alone. And this seems to me a different way of thinking about dance floor democracy. So I wanted to, you know, in my interviews with people, I wanted to hear about what they did, you know, how they experienced their bodies on a dance floor that was widely represented, even at the time, widely represented as kind of the dance floor of the nation. So talking about how my body, you know, what it was like to enter that club in my body and dance with other people in my body at that time, also is talking about my body as part of the national body. And so the dance floor it has several layers of ways of thinking about democracy. Long answer.
Yeah, no, but a good answer. And it ties into where I'd like us to go, which is maybe if you could say a little bit more about how what's going on in the film, The Hollywood Canteen, and then to what extent did the people you interviewed, did they affirm that image, contest that image, question that those images. So first of all, start with the movie maybe a little bit, describing that if people aren't familiar with it, and then kind of move to the kinds of stories people were saying sort of in response to that.
Sure. The movie Hollywood Canteen, which I end my book with that movie, I sort of begin it with a scene from that movie and I end it with that movie, is the most broadly distributed narrative and image of the Hollywood Canteen. It's, you know, people might have seen it on late night television or not. It's not the most famous movie ever made, but it's also something that I find more people have seen than I would have expected. It's also available, like you can get it and watch it. It was made in Hollywood at the same time that the Hollywood Canteen was running. And most of the people in it were volunteers at the Hollywood Canteen. And so it's got a lot of very interesting aspects to it. It was made after the movie Stage Door Canteen, which is about the similar club and which was, you know, started before the Hollywood Canteen. In fact, the Hollywood Canteen was patterned after the Stage Door Canteen. And the Stage Door Canteen movie was also primarily shot in Hollywood, starring people who were dancing at the Hollywood Canteen. So, and in fact, all of those, you know, canteen type movies where hostesses dance with soldiers, where civilians entertain military personnel in canteen type settings, all of those are made by people who volunteered at the Hollywood Canteen. So the Hollywood Canteen, so sometimes when I interviewed people, they would stop in the middle of a story and say, I can't remember if that happened at the film or if it happened at the actual canteen. But the way that the Hollywood Canteen is represented in that film is very fascinating in terms of how race figures onto the dance floor, because it is an integrated cast, but none of the speaking parts aren't integrated. The extras are integrated. And almost every frame of that film, you can find somebody who appears to be a person of color, you know, up in the left corner in a crowd or, you know, somewhere out sitting at a table, a couple sitting at a table in a crowd. You never once see people dancing across race. You see soldiers and hostesses who have shown up in, you know, exact proportions so that, you know, there are people of color and white people dancing in same race couples on the same dance floor. And there's the star couple, there's an idealized couple, which is a really earnest Robert Hutton playing a guy named Slim Green, who's from the Midwest and is a real, you know, real earnest guy. And then Joan Leslie, the girl next door movie star, who he gets to dance with, not only gets to dance with, he gets to kiss her. Not only that, they are a couple by the end of the film. So it's got this white, kind of idealized white heterosexual couple that rises to the privileged pair in this, you know, very managed multicultural image. What was the second part of that question?
And the second part was, yeah, you know, how did your interviews, did they affirm, contest, or question kind of the narrative or this very sort of democratic heterosexual image that's kind of presented in the film?
Okay. The film was very helpful in that it could be a touchstone for people to either say it was exactly like the movie or it was nothing like the movie. It was, you know, it's helpful to have a project that has that some kind of touchstone like that, where I think people knew that I had, you know, that more people would have seen the movie than had actually been to the Hollywood Canteen, and that was a way of explaining what their experience was. So for some people, it was very similar. It was like everybody had a good time. It was wonderful. And for other people, it was like it was nothing like that. I had one white woman told me that there were fights every time she went. And she said that the fights were always about race. They were always I asked her who started the fights. And she said, sometimes the white soldiers would start a fight if a black soldier got too close to white women. And she also said that sometimes black soldiers would start a fight if a white soldier said something very derogatory to them. And so there's a racial tension that she identified as something that she remembered. At the same time, the same person, and this was in almost every interview, even people who really told a different story than the main, nostalgic version, they would identify with parts of it, or they would affirm parts of it. So she also said it was a wonderful place. There was no place like it. She loved going there. She loved dancing with the soldiers. That's one example. I'd say another example would be African-American Marine that I talked to who told me about looking forward to going to the Hollywood Canteen. He had been an actor. He had been in a film, and he was really looking forward to the canteen, both because he could go there as a man in uniform, but he also could reconnect perhaps with people in the motion picture industry and get, you know, keep his career alive while he was in service. But he said he got in there and he was led to a particular part of the club where there were other black soldiers sitting there. He said the nights that he went, there were no black women to dance with, and that he felt that he could not dance with the white women. He said that he wasn't allowed to dance with the white women. When I asked him how he knew that he wasn't allowed to dance with the white women, he gave me he had a lot of interesting things to say about how integration and segregation work. That he said there doesn't have to be a rope across the room, that it's something that you can feel. He was a very interesting interviewee who also gave me a different way of thinking about integration and segregation and rules on the dance floor that really paid attention to embodiment and the many different ways that that social rules are communicated and perceived.
Well, one thing that is, I think, interesting about the Hollywood Canteen is that I think it was the FBI was interested in it, and especially in its creation and what its goals were. So can you maybe explain a little bit about why the canteen caught the attention of the FBI and what they thought might be going on there?
Absolutely. This was really interesting. I think, you know, the FBI chapter was maybe one of my favorite chapters to write about because it was really fascinating to read the almost 90 pages of FBI reports that were in the files. Of course, you know, if we were just to add up the text that wasn't, redacted, crossed out in thick black marker, it would probably be more like 15 pages. But it was really interesting to see that the FBI was surveying the Hollywood Canteen before the thing even opened. And there was an agent there throughout. So and some of the people at the canteen apparently knew this and some didn't. But the reason that the Hollywood Canteen was on the case, I mean, the reason the FBI was on the Hollywood Canteen's case is because of the racial integration, and because racial integration was equated with communism. There were indeed communists, Hollywood communists, who were involved in running the canteen and in the commitment to racial integration. So in reading the FBI files, what you get is quite distinct from the nostalgia in that the good Americans, the people that J. Edgar Hoover is not really concerned about, are the segregationists. It's the people who are trying to get protection for people who want to dance across race, people who are trying to get an official statement that that no, people who are dancing across race will not be stopped by hostesses or by the host in charge or whatever, which was happening all the time. The people who were trying to make sure that this was an integrated space were the people who were being followed, and they were thought to be communists or communist sympathizers. Some were, some weren't. In conjunction with that, I did, some of my interviewees were either members of the Communist Party or thought to be members of the Communist Party by the FBI because they were committed to racial integration. One of the interviews that I really, really enjoyed, I enjoyed them all, but one that comes to mind is with a former blacklisted screenwriter, Bernie Gordon, who wrote a couple of books about his own experiences of being followed by the FBI for great long periods of his life. But Bernie Gordon's wife, Jean Lewin, who I didn't get to talk to because she was deceased, she was a member of the Communist Party, and she was the executive secretary of the Hollywood Canteen. And she was very committed to racial integration. So he let me read her personal files, and I interviewed Bernie, and I interviewed Jean's sister about her work there.
So did the people who founded the canteen, especially those who were more either in the Communist Party or had sympathies, so did they view the dance floor as a place to sort of make a social political statement and to see music as a way to bring people together?
Yes. And in fact, the Communist Party had been doing that for quite a while. So the Communist Party had valued integrated dance and had valued particularly valued African American music in the United States and folk music. There was the Communist Party was and the broader Popular Front, in which not everybody's a member of the Communist Party, but there's a strong left coalition in which Communist Party can be part of that, in this particular time in history. So the music is definitely seen as a way of getting working beyond class hierarchy and trying to create a kind of way of being together that I guess that's mutually beneficial. I think that's another thing is the commitment to democracy of communists is also something that, the communists talk about. So it's not like, some people were pro-democracy and some people were against democracy. Democracy is what the Communist Party was all about. And during World War II, at the time when, Russia is an ally, there's a strong push among American communists to really back the war effort. So Project Win the War is what that is called. And so when I would talk, for instance, Bernie Gordon, when he would talk about integrated dancing, he was like, integrated dancing was something that the communists were particularly protective of, that the broader culture was not. But also, the Communist Party was in Hollywood, was completely behind entertaining the soldiers, boosting morale about winning the war.
So that actually kind of brings up kind of some interesting things, because so here you're telling a story where integration seems to be supported by communists, but not the American government. It's all centered, and this dancing is centered around a form of music that at least is based in African American music, but yet has become sort of very colorblind. So it seems like you're telling a really interesting story in the way sort of different ideas and different sounds and images are getting sort of co-opted in American culture, but like 60 years in the past. Is that accurate?
Yes. And I like that, you just listed all of these different layers. I always, writing this project has always presented me with the challenge of how do you talk about all those things? But I think that's why swing is so interesting, because you could talk about a music that's explicitly says this is African American music at a particular time, and people it's going to mean different things to different people, but there's going to be some kind of way that the fact that it's African American music is going to affect how people relate to it. But swing at that moment, I mean, it's so many things. It means so many things. It slides around. It's all at once African-American music. It's the first moment in which and huge moment in which African-American music is appropriated in a ginormous way in mass culture, mass media. People are making tons of money on it, and the money is locked up in the profits are going to white people, and it's a time when the music, it gets more acceptance as not a titillating music for white people, but kind of a mainstream music, or at least a music that teenagers are presumed to really like. White teenagers are presumed to really like. It's also a symbol of patriotism, American, the American spirit. So when you see reenactments of World War II, it's always swing that's being played and the jitterbug that's being danced, even though people danced all different kinds of music. There were lots of different kinds of dances and music that were popular in the 1940s. Swing rises up to be the symbol of patriotism at that time. And even I think that's what's interesting about swing is its effectiveness to mean many things to many people at the same time, and isn't this what American culture so often does, is take something like, take an African American musical form and somehow have these battles about it within it, even when and it's more the debate doesn't go away. Like the debate never goes away about what is the race of that music.
Yeah. So what were there some other good or surprising stories that your interview shared, but that just maybe didn't quite make it into the book, that you still want to kind of talk about or share?
Of course. I mean, there's tons of stories that didn't make it into the book. I think the hardest thing about organizing interview material, because I interviewed about 60 people, and a lot of those interviews were quite lengthy. Some people I talked to more than once. And when you try to take that material and put it into a book, you end up with some people that you'll spend a lot of time with, because that story can do a lot of, that story gets at a lot of things that people talked about. And then other people, you'll have several similar stories. And so what you'll write about is the pattern of that story, that this is something that frequently came up. And you might use one example, but then you'll collapse everybody else's story into that. And that's always painful, because every story is different. And there's certainly, if I could have spent more time writing about the interaction, I would have even started maybe remembering things myself about that interview that I don't actually get to talk about in the book. So I think what I am happy with is I think I did get to get most of the themes that came up in the interviews. I'm trying to think of a particular story that didn't make it in, or a particular interviewee that I didn't spend enough time with. I'll tell you, here's one. I got to talk with Roddy McDowell's sister, Virginia, and I loved her. She was so interesting, and she's in the book a tiny little bit, but I sure would have liked to have spent more time with that interview, because she had a very interesting perspective. She and Roddy were already actors, and they were living in England. And in the 30s, they were British. They were living in England, and when the war was looking really bad, their mother took the opportunity to take them to Hollywood to so they would be safer, but also to see how the kids would do in the movies. And Roddy did quite well. So did Virginia, but she was not the star that her brother became. But she acted in the movies and had quite an interesting life in Hollywood. So she was really interesting to talk to. She talked about what it was like to be a British person in Hollywood during World War II, and how she said that most of the people I talked about didn't talk about is, she said, most of the guys that they knew that were killed were British. Of course they knew Americans that were killed as well, but they said most of them were British. And so that was something on her mind a lot. Her father, their father was in the British, I think, Merchant Marine. And so she would wait for word from her father, and she would dance with the soldiers, and her family, her mom and her brother, and she would hang out with. She said there was a community of British character actors who lived in Santa Monica. We would hang out with them, and they also, the mother would bring home soldiers from the Hollywood canteen, which was, I mean, according to everything I've read, that's absolutely against the rules. You're not supposed to meet soldiers at the canteen afterwards, but a lot of people apparently did. And with Virginia McDowell's mother, who had actually met her husband, her mother had met her father in a similar kind of situation where during World War One, so entertaining soldiers during World War One. But anyway, they brought home soldiers from the Hollywood canteen who would spend the weekend. They would be forced to go to mass. I believe she said they'd be fed well. And she had these hilarious pictures of soldiers carrying her brother around like he was a little boy. And he was small, but he was not that much, not terribly much younger than they were, but he always looked much younger than his age. I would have liked to have written more about her. She also showed me a picture in her scrapbook of her brother, and she said, this picture is taken by one of my favorite photographers, Elizabeth Taylor. So, you know, that was very special. But each one, you know, if you're an oral historian, if you're a good oral historian, you're an improviser, and you go into a situation with preparation. You don't just go in cold. You go in with the preparation of knowing some basic things about the person, whatever you can find out. You go in with the preparation of you know, you have a few things that you want to start with, and then you're prepared to follow that person where they go. And but the most important thing about the readiness is to be present in the moment of that interaction. It totally is an improvisation. They're reading you, you're reading them. It's like a dance. Where I move affects where they move affects where I move. I figure out how to answer a question, not by the truth of who they are, but by what I'm feeling about who they are at that moment, and vice versa. So it's a really interesting practice.
Well, one of the real treats of the book is that all these dance metaphors that you're talking about here in terms of your methods, you incorporate them in the writing. So how did you decide to make that kind of unique or those choices as you were writing to sort of really put your methods out there and kind of what it's like to be an oral historian?
Oh, that I can't, you know, Rich, that makes me so tremendously happy that you comment on the writing. It makes me so happy because I really do. You know, I am a writer. I am a writer. I've always been a writer. I want to be a writer. That's why I'm an academic, because I thought if I'm an academic, you know, people will like it that I'm writing, you know, so it makes me so happy to hear that. And for me, writing is thinking. Writing is a way of thinking. So I think what this book allowed me to do was to really stretch out in writing in ways that I was more afraid to do, say pre-tenure. So you know, not to break it down like that, because I've actually never felt that constrained. I've always used elements of creative writing in my work, but this, I felt like this was my opportunity to really see what writing could do, in terms of theorizing complex ideas. So when I would come up with a contradiction or when I would feel reoriented in an interview, I would try to find ways of writing that could get at that feel of it. So I wanted the writing to be a dance. I wanted to invite readers to dance with me. I wanted to make space for readers to think differently than I did about what was going on. I wanted to create space in the writing for people I didn't get to interview, or for people who the interviewees wouldn't know about, people who, Because, you know, when you think of yourself on a dance floor, a crowded dance floor, you're seeing and interacting with the people who are right in front of you. So you might dance with, you know, 50 people, but there's other people who are beyond the heads and shoulders of the people that you're dancing with. And their movements are also shaping that space and shaping what's possible. So I wanted to find ways of writing that could creatively bring that in, not just make a paragraph where I say that and move on. I wanted the writing to grapple with that.
Well, one of the other dances that you're doing in this book is that you're dancing between the 1940s and sort of the post 9/11 America, because, yes. And so how do you dance with these sort of oral interview partners through kind of the nostalgia and patriotism that's sort of happening in the early 2000s?
Oh, yeah. Okay. This is an area I honestly didn't know I was getting into this when I started this project, because I started the interviews for the Hollywood Canteen project in the year 2000. And at that time, World War II seemed very, very, very far away. When I interviewed people, it felt far away. We had conversations about the past, and it really felt like we were talking about the past. We were talking in the present, but it really felt like we were talking about something that happened long ago. I was teaching courses like I had this, you know, World War II course, that a popular culture World War II course that I used to teach at University of Kansas. And prior to 9/11, the students would say things like, oh, well, Americans wouldn't believe this kind of, you know, propaganda today. You know, they didn't buy, like, even they tended to like Rosie the Riveter better than some of the other propaganda. But even then they were like, gee, you know, I don't think that a poster would make people act differently today. And then you've got post 9/11. And of course, you know, I'm not going to speak lightly about that. That was a tremendous, you know, tragedy. But what really was eerie to me is here I'm writing this book, and after 9/11, all of a sudden there's all of this flashback in popular culture to World War II popular culture. And so you've got comparisons to the trade towers and other attacks with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Not a whole lot of discussion of what's different about those two historical events. And then you've got the New York Times reprinting Norman Rockwell stuff. You've got swing dance, jitterbug imagery popping up everywhere. And you've got people waving flags. And there's a kind of there's a double time that gets inserted into my oral histories that's even more intense than the usual double time of oral history, where you're talking about a past and you're talking about in the present. So that my interviewees and I both were talking about, when we talked about World War II, it really was obvious that we were no longer talking about World War II. We were talking about U.S. We're talking about the nation. We're talking about the nation at war. So interviewees would tell me their opinions about what was going on in the world. The world events kept changing and kept in the present. People talked less about the 9/11 attacks as time went on, because I interviewed people between the year 2000 and the year 2010. So people would talk about wars of the present throughout that period. And every time there was a change, it would change the ways that the interviews went. What I guess was powerful to me about those conversations was how different the people I interviewed were in terms of their opinions about war and about America, about patriotism. And this again was a very stark contrast, because there's all this celebration at the same time as the popular culture is you know, remembering the popular culture of the past, there's also all of this stuff about the greatest generation. What's great about them is they're all the same. They all agree on everything. They're all, you know, 100% behind the government. And here I am talking to people in the present who are members of that generation who are watching themselves being celebrated on television as united, and they've all got different opinions. So, you know, so that was something that I think gave me a renewed passion and a different passion for the project, which I started to feel like it was very, very, very important to remember the difference and to remember political difference as something that's important to acknowledge in democratic practices. I see it. I don't see, you know, a kind of celebration of everybody being the on the same page as emblematic of democracy. So, and that generation, I don't, you know, I don't know that they did either. And some did, some didn't. There were people with all different kinds of political orientations.
Well, thank you for allowing me to take so much of your time today. But before we go, is there a project on which you're working on now?
Sure, Rich. I think there are several projects I'm working on now. And right now, I'm really interested in taking some of this, some of what I've learned from working on Dance Floor Democracy. I'm really interested in taking some of that into research. And so actually, you know, research practice. So actually doing improvisatory collaborative research with other people. And I've had a couple of really positive experiences with that. One is with the Melba Liston Research Collective. Melba Liston was a trombonist, arranger, jazz trombonist, arranger, composer, band leader who hadn't really been written about very much. And so I was a member of a collective of feminist jazz musicologists, all of us with different training, and we went in and went through her papers together and worked on a special issue of Black Music Research Journal on Melba Liston, and that was a blast. I mean, really, we didn't just separate it out and write different parts. We went to the archive together and went through 40 boxes of lead sheets and scores, and we talked, and we played music, and it was, that's how research should be. You know, it was dynamite. And I'm also working on a project of a music. There's a musical instrument that Pauline Oliveros developed a few years ago. That's called the Adaptive Use Musical Instrument. And if people listening want to look it up, you can actually download the instrument for free. It operates on camera tracking. And the idea is for bodily movement to trigger sound, and that it is adaptive, so that it's supposed to adapt to every body. She designed it for people with limited mobility or very narrow range. We all have limited mobility, right? You know, I'm flying to San Francisco today, but I'm going to take a plane. You know, so we all have limited mobility, but narrower range of mobility and wider range of ability can play the same range of the instrument. It's so cool. And you can do mixed ability improvisation with using free improvisation, this instrument, which is monetarily free. And you can, any group of people of living bodies can make something together with this instrument.
Well, thank you very much. It has been great talking with you today, Sherry.
It's been great talking with you today too, Rich. Thanks so much.
You have been listening to the New Books in Popular Music podcast. Today, I've been talking with Sherry Tucker about her new book, Dance Floor Democracy, The Social Geography of Memory at the Hollywood Canteen. This is your host, Richard Scherr. Thank you for listening.